This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program have Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. If Congress passes a law that the president disagrees with, the president has the power to veto that legislation. It is a very public action, sometimes dramatic and confrontational. And the result is that law has to go back to the Congress, and the members there in the Congress have to see if they can come up with some additional votes to see if they can override the president's veto. However, President Bush has taken a rather different approach. He has made frequent use of what previously had been a little-known tool called a presidential signing statement. This allows the president, as President Bush has done it, to sign the bill and then say, I take exception to certain aspects on constitutional grounds, and I'm not going to follow that. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll be talking a bit about signing statements and presidential power. And our guest for the program is Philip Cooper. He's professor of public administration in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University. He's also taught at a number of other universities, including Georgia State, the State University of New York at Albany, University of Kansas, and University of Vermont. He's authored a number of books and articles dealing with various subjects, including public administration, constitutional law, law and public policy, and just one, because it bears on the subject we're talking about here this morning, at least in some respects. I do want to mention that book is titled By Order of the President, The Use and Abuse of Presidential Direct Action. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they're just brief so that we can accommodate as many different callers as possible, keep things moving along, but we're certainly welcoming people into the conversation with questions and comments. The number to call, if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and we'll pay for the call. And that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL. If that makes it any easier, probably doesn't. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Cooper, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I realize that I have, I think I probably have oversimplified somewhat what it is we're talking about. So we'll get into it in some depth. And I think perhaps the place to start is simply to talk about what it is we're talking about. I think you've noted, other people have noted, that until fairly recently, the use of the presidential signing statement by the president had not gotten much attention. The media had taken note of the fact that the president was not vetoing anything. And I think it is correct that in his entire first term, he didn't veto a single piece of legislation, and I don't think he has to date vetoed anything. But he has indeed used this, and only recently has this started to get attention. So I think that probably for some people having read recent stories about this, this will be the first time they've ever heard of it. So let's begin there with the most basic question and ask, what is a presidential signing statement?
Well, a presidential signing statement is very much what you described earlier, but I think it's useful to step back and draw a little bit of a distinction. When most people hear about the president signing a bill into law, they're used to seeing or hearing the Rose Garden ceremony in which the president makes a bit of a speech and thanks congressional supporters and others who worked hard to get a law passed. And indeed, that's one of the things that the press tends to see and report on. But it's also the case that in this administration, and certainly at least since the Reagan administration, it's become a more common practice also to issue a formal statement at the same time, which is about the president's view of the new law, including whatever objections the president thinks there may be to provisions of that law. The president may take the opportunity in that statement to announce the constitutional limitations that he thinks apply, and also direct executive branch officials on how they should administer the law in an acceptable manner, which of course means the way the president interprets it, rather than the way it is perhaps written specifically in the legislation. And then this is actually made public but most people aren't aware of it. It became public, I think, over the last year, primarily because of a couple of coincidences, and one of them had actually to do with the appointment of now Justice Alito. Justice Alito, back in February of 1986, was a member of the Justice Department under the Reagan administration, and that administration had a task force on how to protect the executive powers of the presidency against what at that time was felt to be intrusions by the other branches. And this task force was looking at devices that could be used to try to pursue that goal. Mr. Alito, in February of 1986, wrote a memorandum explaining how the presidential signing statement could be used to expand executive power. It just so happens that that memorandum surfaced the weekend before his hearings began in January of this year, and it also happened on the heels of an action by the president on December 30th, in which he issued a very controversial signing statement having to do with the detainees at Guantanamo.
Given the, I guess I'm a little bit surprised that given the fact that that some people, particularly say members of Congress, might argue that this is part of a larger pattern of this administration of enlarging executive power of the executive at the expense of the power of the legislative branch, that someone wouldn't have made some public of statements on this, or at least made some statements to that, some member of Congress wouldn't made statements to that effect before now.
Well, the device has a number of attractive qualities to it. One of them is that presidents don't come out and simply say, I'm not going to obey the law as written. Rather, the language that's used in these things is fairly arcane, and unless one really is sitting with the copy of the new law under one hand and the copy of the signing statement under the other and has the training to be able to read the detail and see where the conflicts are, it can be tough to understand exactly what the president is saying. It's usually the case that these things have been prepared by the Justice Department, the Office of Legal Counsel, though in this administration the White House has been involved, particularly through the Office of Vice President Cheney and Mr. David Addington, his number two. And so they've been very careful about identifying some particular kinds of points they've wanted to make, and unless one was watching, it wouldn't be all that clear what was happening. It's partly an idea of looking at an individual signing statement. It's also then the idea of looking at the pattern of things that the White House is saying over time about its authority, about limitations on the authority of the Congress, and even in some cases trying to issue what are very much like judicial opinions. So, for example, in the December 30th statement, there was a part of the law that was in question that had to do with the rights of people at Guantanamo to proceed in court, to have the courts decide whether or not they had some rights that weren't being protected. The legislation said that henceforth those suits would not be allowed to go to court, but that was part of an understanding with Senator Levin of Michigan and Senator Graham, South Carolina, that in fact the cases, there were already cases in court that could test the president's power, and those would be allowed to go forward. Well, the administration issued a signing statement which reads like a judicial opinion and says these people do not have any right to pursue a lawsuit, and just a few days after that, the Justice Department went into court to try to block all of those cases, and they have not succeeded, as indicated in the recent Hamdan ruling by the Supreme Court. But unless one knows what one's looking for, it's pretty tough to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. I think that people trying to defend the administration's use of the signing statement have said something like, the Bush administration, President Bush, is not the first president to do this. In fact, it's my understanding that the first president to issue a signing statement was James Monroe. Although in recent years they have, most of the ones that have been issued have come in recent years, but apparently the president's father, the first President Bush, President Clinton, President Reagan, they all did it. Is there something different about the pattern here, the number, the quality, the implications of these that makes the current president Bush's use of the signing statement different than the way that previous presidents have done it?
The short answer is yes. And let me take that apart in a couple pieces. Mm-hmm. First is, while it is true that some presidents in the past have used these things, one study showed that there were, prior to the Reagan years, there were only 16 examples under 13 different presidents where a president had used this kind of a device. And in the sweep of American history, that's virtually nothing. It's very, very rare that this kind of thing occurred. But it was the Reagan administration that deliberately used this. In fact, Attorney General Meese at that time was able to get the people who publish legislative histories to include the presidential signing statement. The hope at that time was that people would look at the administration's interpretation of a new law as part of the legislative history, even though, of course, it isn't, but that was the desire. And it was during that administration that there began to be some confrontations, and some of them were a bit silly. I'll be glad to describe one or two of them, but they produced major battles. Yes, these devices were used during the Reagan administration more than they had been used before. And in fact, what's funny is Mr. Alito was criticized for having written this memo. But in the memo, he warned that this would be something that would prompt real fights with Congress if Congress understood what was going on, because it was an obvious claim to enhance executive power at the expense of the Congress. So he cautioned the use of it relatively rarely. And then that was the case. The administration used it, but not as systematically as would later be the case. The George Herbert Walker Bush administration certainly did use the device, used it as much as, and indeed a little bit more than the Reagan administration. The Clinton administration used it, and in some rather controversial ways, in fact. But what's happened with the Bush administration is right from the beginning, at least from the fall of 2001, what we saw was a pattern of using these statements to claim the widest possible scope for executive power, to place as many limitations as possible on claims to authority by the Congress, and in some cases to preempt the judiciary. It's been a consistent pattern over time with extremely expansive language, and not just in areas of national security, really sometimes in areas that seemed rather silly. I'll give you an example. Just a week after the attacks of 9/11, the president signed a bill creating the Brown versus Board of Education Commemorative Commission. Now, the legislation said that the president should consider recommendations from various groups, including members of Congress, leadership, and some of the civil rights organizations, as for possible membership on that commission. The White House issued a signing statement, and again, this is a week after 9/11, saying, well, as a matter of comity, that is, mutual respect among the branches, the president would possibly consider some of these things, but it should be remembered that the appointment power belonged to the president of the United States under Article 2. It's difficult to understand why the White House thought it necessary to make that point at that time in this context, and it's just grown from there.
Mm-hmm. Our guests in this hour, Philip Cooper. He's professor of public administration in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. And we're talking this morning about presidential signing statements and executive power. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Where does the authority, or where would the administration argue that the authority to do this, that is effectively a kind of line item veto that would enable them to sign a piece of legislation and yet say there are aspects of it they feel are unconstitutional and so that they don't feel bound to carry them out. Where does the administration argue the authority to do that comes from?
Well, there are two answers to that question, and one of them is a bit ironic for some people in any case, and that is under Article 2, which contains the president's powers in the Constitution, the president has the duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. And the administrations that have used this device have said that means that the president has an obligation not to implement or enforce an unconstitutional piece of legislation. A piece of legislation that violates the separation of powers by interfering with the powers of the executive branch is by definition unconstitutional, and therefore the executive branch should not implement it, and the president is required to avoid doing that under the Constitution. The other argument that's made is the president is the head of the executive branch, and this administration claims at least that he has the power of supervising the unitary executive. That is to say, he has the power to protect the constitutional powers of the presidency, and if Congress acts to intrude on those powers as the defender of the executive branch, he will take such actions as are necessary to do that. The only problem, of course, is that the discussion of a veto appears in the legislative article, Article 1 of the Constitution. It's there as a check on legislative power, not as a separate executive power, and it was not to be used in just sections of a law. Indeed, the United States Supreme Court in 1998 made it very clear in a case involving the line item veto that Congress had created. It was kind of interesting that a Republican Congress had pressed the matter, but the first president who was able to use the line item veto was, of course, Bill Clinton. The Supreme Court said no. The framers were very clear. They did not want an absolute veto or a partial veto. You either veto the entire legislation and send it back to Congress for further consideration, or you sign it into law and you carry it out. And in this particular case, in some ways it's an absolute veto in the sense that the president doesn't send anything back to Congress. So Congress really has nothing to do. There's nothing to object to at that point, unless Congress wants to pass a whole new piece of legislation, and then the president can do precisely the same thing all over again.
So then that makes it sound as if the Congress has no recourse here, that there's nothing the Congress can do about this except, as you say, pass another law, and then there would be the risk that, or the possibility, the president would do the same thing. That almost puts Congress out of business.
Well, it could if Congress doesn't act. And one of the problems is Congress hasn't been doing its job. And I would argue that that's true of both parties here, although it seems that there are some members who've come to have more of a realization of this. There's a brand new book out by Thomas Mann and Norman Ornstein called The Broken Branch, which describes some of the problems with Congress failing to follow its own procedures and do things right in the first instance so that, you know, be passing laws that it would be better able to then conduct oversight about. And in fact, this Congress has done almost no significant level of oversight, with the exception of a couple of hearings on the NSA programs, the National Security Agency programs regarding intelligence gathering with regard to telephone communications. But really, even those were minor. In one case, you had only one witness, and that one witness was the Attorney General of the United States. So Congress hasn't acted. But I can give you an example of one time when things did occur. During the Reagan administration, and it arose over something that will give you an idea of how silly these things can be, it had to do with a contract to clean the sewers at West Point, of all things. The White House had signed a piece of legislation called the Competition and Contracting Act, and the president was of the view that portions of that act intruded on the executive power. So the Office of Management and Budget was directed to tell the agencies of the federal government not to do it the way the statute said to do it, but to do it the way the White House interpreted the law. And, of course, there were, in that case, losing bidders. Very unusual for people to be able to get standing to sue in this case, because it's difficult to connect what the White House did with the signing statement with an injury that somebody actually suffered, because it occurs several steps down the line from when that happened. In this case, though, some people lost the bid, and they could sue. And the case went to court, and the courts very quickly said, I'm sorry, the president can't do this. The president has a duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. This law was constitutional, and if the president didn't think so, then it should have been determined by a court. The White House at that time, Attorney General Meese, said, well, we're not sure we're bound by that, and it told the Congress that. In fact, even President Reagan was not directly involved in this discussion, but Mr. Meese was leading the charge for the administration. And he went into the pages of the New York Times and wrote an op-ed piece about why the administration had an obligation not to obey in this particular case. The New York Times replied by saying, well, you know, Ms. Secretary Bennett's concerned that young school kids don't know how a bill becomes a law. Maybe the Attorney General needs to learn that. What it finally came down to was the Congress, both parties, got together and threatened to zero out the appropriation for the Attorney General's office if the administration didn't back off, and they did back off. So Congress can use the budgetary club if it wants to. It could use subpoenas. The question is, how many subpoenas have been used to acquire information by this Congress or recent Congresses, for that matter? There are things they could do. They just haven't done it.
You talked about the fact that the administration is saying, look, there's this in Article 2, this is the part of the Constitution that lays out the powers of the executive. There is this provision that says that the executive should be on the lookout for any legislation that might be unconstitutional. If the Congress sends us something that we think is unconstitutional, then we can say, look, we think this is unconstitutional, and we are going to decide we're not going to abide by that. During any of this time, have there been any sort of rumblings from over at the judicial branch, people saying, look, the job of deciding what may or may not be constitutional is ours. That's not the power of, or the responsibility or the purpose of the executive branch.
Well, I think very clearly, I mean, one of the things that we haven't seen is a clear lawsuit that targets specifically a signing statement. But if you look at the recent decision in the Hamdan case of 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court absolutely rejected the interpretation that the administration had given to the provisions of the Detainee Protection Act and also the restrictions on their ability to sue. There's no doubt that in this particular case, although they didn't address it directly, the administration's interpretation that was announced in that signing statement was very clearly rejected on both counts. Justice Scalia, in his dissenting opinion, made reference to the fact that the court didn't really directly even consider the signing statement, but to anyone who reads it, it's quite clear that the court was rejecting the arguments that were made there. It wasn't necessary to mention the signing statement because the Justice Department actually offered those substantive arguments when it argued the case before the Supreme Court, so it didn't really need to refer to the signing statement. And it is the case that during the Reagan administration, when this case went to court that I was just talking about, the Ameron case, both the United States Circuit Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit in Philadelphia and the United States Circuit Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in California made it abundantly clear that indeed, that by citing old cases like Marbury against Madison and even reminding the president of U.S. against Nixon, the so-called Nixon, the Watergate case, that yes, it is the duty and province of the judicial branch department to say what the law is and not the executive branch. And of course, the argument here is, wait a minute, Article 2 doesn't say anything about being on the lookout and then disobeying a new statute. What it says is the president has a duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Mm-hmm. And we don't have any case law that would uphold the idea of a president using that power to sign a bill into law on the one hand and then declare that he wasn't going to be bound by it on the other.
Mm. But it sounds like as if what would have to happen here is in every instance there's been a signing statement. If somebody thinks it's problematic and if somebody thinks that the executive was exceeding its power, then in every case that it would have to go to the Supreme Court.
Well, unless and until we get some opinions from the Supreme Court that would pronounce on the question of the ability of the president to issue signing statements and issued some kind of a broad ruling on that point. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of this device, as far as the presidents are concerned, at least modern presidents, is it's extraordinarily difficult to get a case into court for two reasons. First, when these signing statements are issued to anyone who's not read one, they can be really hard to fathom. And indeed, I've put on my website a connection to an article that I wrote with a lot of the language in it and also some links to some signing statements that somebody can look at. But the fact of the matter is it's really difficult because the president makes very general statements that there are parts of these laws that are of constitutional concern. And so they rarely will say this particular provision violates the law for the following reason, and therefore we are going to do or not do these things. It just doesn't happen that way. So it's extremely difficult to track down. And it's also hard to have a particular individual be identified. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When the president signed the law that created the 9/11 Commission, at that time, the White House has taken a consistent position at that time and since that it will decide what information it will give to Congress. There are many times that Congress will place into legislation a requirement that the White House develop some reports and send them to Congress on a periodic basis about what's going on in a particular area. This administration has consistently taken a position that Congress cannot mandate that it's a violation of the unitary executive, and that they will be treated as advisory and requests, not demands, in the law. In that particular case, the president said exactly the same thing, and as we know, one of the problems that the 9/11 Commission had was it couldn't get information that it needed to conduct its investigations, so much so, in fact, that the commission had to extend its work because it couldn't get it done on time. At that point, then, the administration opposed the extension of the 9/11 Commission. It finally relented, it finally provided the information, and we did get the reports.
We are at our midpoint. Again, let me introduce the guest once again, Philip Cooper. He's professor of public administration and the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University, Portland, Oregon. And we're talking this morning about signing statements and executive power. And questions are certainly welcome. We have someone here standing by, would welcome others. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800 222 9455. And the caller is in Effingham County on line number 4. Hello.
I would like to ask about the executive order. Is there a difference in wartime than in peacetime? And if so, could they this could be included in drilling for oil in Alaska or in else places that, you know, we've been stopped from drilling? That was the first question I had. And the second question is, can he explain to me what's the difference between an agreement and a treaty, like with Mexico, and I'll listen on the radio. Thank you much for your time.
All right. Well, it certainly is the case that I think that the administration has argued that there is this precedent for an expansion of presidential power during wartime. And in fact, they made the argument when Congress has objected to some of the things that they've done. The Bush administration has said, well, look, back after September 11th, you, the Congress, authorized the president to take whatever action was necessary to fight terrorism and protect America, and refer back to World War II and the kind of open mandate that the Congress gave Franklin Roosevelt at that time. And the Bush administration has simply said, look, we've done it before. That's the way we do it. In wartime, the president, you know, virtually the limits on presidential power are off, and we do that as a way of protecting America. Are there really in something that you point to some actual kind of definitions of presidential power in peacetime and in wartime?
Well, we've had a number of cases, of course, in which presidents have acted, and we can certainly trace these back at least as far as the Civil War, where the president has acted, and then Congress has come along later and issued something sometimes called a War Powers Resolution. We've seen this in the Civil War, World War I, World War II. We've seen this a number of times where Congress will come along and ratify or support what the president has done in the early days. And at different times, Congress has supported different levels of authority on the part of the administration to act. Some presidents, of course, claim that, well, it can do things with or without Congress under those conditions. And this is sometimes called the prerogative power, that sometimes an emergency is so serious that the president simply has to go and above and beyond. But the Supreme Court has often reminded presidents that the Constitution applies in times of war and in times of peace. Certainly we saw this when Harry Truman seized the steel mills during the Korean War, and the Supreme Court reminded him in that particular case Congress had disagreed with his claim that he had the authority to do that, and the Supreme Court reversed his action. That action was taken by executive order. An executive order is a little different than a signing statement. That's when the president orders members of the executive branch to act or not to do something, and it is a legal document. It does carry the force of law. More recently, in this administration, we've had three major decisions of the United States Supreme Court saying to this president, look, it is the case, first of all, that the Constitution operates during wartime as well as in peacetime. Secondly, it is not a blank check that the president can do whatever he thinks is necessary to do. And third, that we do look at the relationship between what Congress is saying and what the president is saying under these conditions. It's recognized that the president has to act to protect the country, but that doesn't mean that the power is unlimited. You were asking another question about the difference between a treaty and an agreement, and this gets to be really pretty complicated, but let me give you an example where the Supreme Court has sometimes looked at an executive agreement, that is an agreement that a president reaches with another head of state, and upheld it and treated it like a treaty. If you remember back in the days of the Iran hostage crisis at the end of the Carter administration and then the beginning of the Reagan administration, there had been hostages taken. Well, at that point, a resolution was finally reached by both President Carter and incoming President Reagan, and a settlement was achieved. The hostages were released, and part of that settlement was to say that cases that were pending in American courts against Iranian assets or money that might be out there would not be allowed to go forward. These things would have to be resolved by a claims commission. Well, a lot of companies who had cases pending objected, said, you can't do that. We've got a right to have these things litigated. Supreme Court said in that case, unanimously, that that agreement, even though it wasn't ratified like a treaty, would be a sufficient authority to stop pending lawsuits. And so it treated an executive agreement a lot like a treaty, even though Congress hadn't, the Senate hadn't ratified it.
We will continue here. We'll take another call. Champaign County, this is line number one. Hello.
Hi. It's another show, but there's another Iranian writer who's suggests that indeed there was a informal deal made to delay the hostage release till just at the old October surprise thing that Gary Sick pursued. But that is another show. The idea that this wartime has anything to do with it is kind of belied by the fact that Bloomberg reported this the Friday before the 4th of July holiday, that the NSA, not the wiretapping, but the cooperation with AT&T actually started 8 months before the 911. So they can't say that the resolution passed to protect the nation had anything to do with that. I want to get back, and that relates to the idea that Alito wrote this up for the Reagan administration. If you said it, I missed it. How many times did Reagan use it? And this was clearly the idea of restoring this idea of the unitary executive, right? This is right out of the Federalist Society's proceedings in some ways, isn't it? Wouldn't you say?
Well, I think it's funny. The term unitary executive has been used in a variety of different ways by different people. In fact, in the middle of the Alito hearings, Senator Leahy asked him about the relationship between the unitary executive theory and the use of these devices called signing statements. And then Judge Alito said, well, I don't really see a connection at all. And, you know, one could suggest that, well, perhaps he was being a little less than direct, but one could also say, no, actually he was following the use of the unitary executive idea as he understood it during the Reagan years. It's kind of a continuum. One end of that continuum says, and nobody objects to this, the president's the head of the executive branch, the president's responsible for the executive branch, so the president has to have some supervisory authority over the executive branch. The other end of the continuum is really different, though, and that's where this administration has been operating, because it says, look, the president has powers that go above and beyond those specified in law or in the Constitution, for that matter, and that those powers are, in fact, exclusive. There's no indication that Justice Alito ever subscribed to that particular set of arguments, but that has been the set of arguments that's been used in this administration. And in fact, by my count, in the first 4 years of this administration, that particular argument was used more than any other reason for offering constitutional objections to provisions passed by Congress. I counted some 82 of these. The Reagan administration was much more selective. There were only a few a year, and they tended to be there tended to be some conflict. There were also, by the way, I would add, some of these used during the Clinton administration. Probably the best known one was when involving Los Alamos National Laboratories. You may recall the whole business about lost hard drives from computers and other things that were going on, real concerns about security. The administration in the fall of 1999 signed a law in which Congress created something called the National Nuclear Security Administration within the executive, Energy Department, although it was to be an independent agency. And the administration essentially said, we don't like the way Congress designed this device, and so we're going to do it differently. Just a few months later, some more problems arose at Los Alamos, and there were hearings in which both Democrats and Republicans absolutely just chastised Secretary Richardson beyond belief and told him that they weren't going to tolerate this kind of behavior, and then the administration would not be allowed to tell the Congress what it would and would not enforce in laws that were passed. This administration has regularly pushed that envelope and consistently pushed it. It's hard to know how many times it's done it. There's one law that I counted, for example, one statute had to do with an Appropriations Act in 2004. There were actually 32 different constitutional objections, but some of them were so broad I couldn't figure out exactly how many provisions they were objecting to.
They don't even specify that? I mean, that's sort of a blanket kind of approach to not accepting the Congress's authority. That's I'm actually surprised. I thought they sort of at least lined it out. It seems so blatantly unconstitutional. It seems to me also that you mentioned that in the Clinton administration, the Congress did object. It seems the weakness of the Congress is partially their own fault because they've abdicated this thing. And the illustration of that, and then I'll sign off, is that you only have to go to the Constitution to say that, you know, find article, I forget what it is now, but regarding detainee treatment, captures on land and sea are specifically in the Constitution listed as being province of the Congress, which doesn't give me much hope about what they're going to do on that issue. Thank you.
All right.
Well, it is the case that the Congress is very much at fault for failing to act. There's been an utter unwillingness to conduct serious oversight. Again, to the best of my knowledge, I can think of only one time that anybody has issued a subpoena in an oversight process to get information, despite the fact that there have been repeated claims by both Republicans and Democrats about the unwillingness of the administration to provide the information that it needed to determine whether laws were being carried out. So there's just no question. The other thing is, when Congress suspends the rules and writes legislation on the floor of the Congress and then creates post hoc legislative history, that creates a real problem. An example of that is occurred when just a couple weeks ago when we had the Hamdan case decided concerning Guantanamo. Lindsey Graham and Senator Kyle from Arizona actually inserted material into the debate record after the fact, and they tried to make it appear that in the debate they had made clear that the language of the statute said no more lawsuits from Guantanamo. The Supreme Court looked at that and said, look, it's very clear that wasn't part of the debate. It's very clear you folks went back there and tried to manufacture some legislative history that didn't exist. And it's true. And so the fact is that the Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, are very much responsible for not doing what needed to be done. I will say that there have been members, certainly Arlen Specter of the Judiciary Committee has taken an awful lot of heat from his partisans, because he has at least objected to a number of these things, certainly the signing statements, and also called for hearings on other matters. So it's not been uniformly the case that members have abandoned their job, but it really is very, very much the case that Congress isn't doing its job. But, you know, as to your other question, let me just read you the opening statement in this one law that I was just mentioning. It had to do with the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2004. The signing statement begins, many portions of the CAA are inconsistent with the constitutional authority of the president to conduct foreign affairs, command the armed forces, protect sensitive information, supervise the unitary executive, make appointments, and make recommendations to Congress. Many other provisions unconstitutionally condition execution of the laws by the executive branch upon approval of congressional committees. Is that broad enough for you? It's just amazing and so hard to know exactly what it is they claim to be objecting to. The beauty of that is it's also extraordinarily difficult to challenge what he's done.
Yeah, I think that the way that we've been talking about this is the use of the signing statements as a kind of an end run around Congress, avoiding the very public and contentious act of vetoing and the possibility that the Congress would be able to override the veto and instead signing it, but in a more quiet way saying, but these provisions we're not going to go along with this. After all, the Congress is controlled by the majorities in both houses are the Republicans. And is there some sense in which perhaps some members of Congress are just fine with what the president has done? And the reason they haven't objected is because they don't object.
Well, I've yet to hear anyone in Congress make a serious defense of presidential signing statements used in this way, mm-hmm. of either party. I don't know that that's the case. I wouldn't deny that there's a fair bit of partisanship involved here, which is interesting because if we go back and look at other presidents, we've seen bipartisan criticism of the members of the president who's done this sort of thing. There's no question it's an end run around the Congress, and the question then is what Congress is prepared to do about it. And the fact of the matter is, for whatever reason, this Congress hasn't been prepared. Now, it should be said, I was just saying a moment ago that there are some Republicans who have been critics, like specifically Arlen Specter, and there have been a few others. In fact, interestingly enough, Senator Graham himself, on a number of occasions, has been critical of these things. And there were some questions raised during the Alito hearings and since then about this, but they haven't been willing to do anything about it. That's contrasted with 1999, during the Clinton administration, when the Republicans were really all over the president about this. And in fact, I testified before the House Judiciary Committee at that time And there was there were several bills introduced in an effort to try to figure out some way to put some constraints on the president at that time. So some of those same voices that we heard very loudly in 1999, we're not hearing today.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Philip Cooper. He's professor of public administration in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University and has written a number of books and many articles dealing with public administration, constitutional law, and law and public policy. And we're talking here this morning in this part of Focus 580 about presidential signing statements and executive power. We have a caller here from Kankakee. We'll go to them next on our line four. Hello.
Hello. Your caller would comment that the issuance of presidential proclamations at the time of signing laws, as described by Professor Cooper, are occasions in which the, quote, unitary executive to parade before the United States his provocative refusals to faithfully execute the laws of the United States. And your caller would inquire as to whether the appropriate remedies for these are not for the Congress to adopt additional legislation, but rather for the House to send over to the Senate articles of impeachment of the President of the United States. Thank you.
All right. Well, you have a comment on that?
Well, there have been serious questions raised. One of the reasons I think that signing statements have attracted so much attention, and in a way it surprised me, because there have been so many other things going on. But it seems as though the comment that I've heard from many people on both ends of the political spectrum and from both political parties, as I've talked with a number of people about this, is that it is the case that the signing statement seems to be one more assertion of unilateral executive authority that just seems to push one step too far. Because it seems to so clearly violate, and I think it does in many respects clearly violate, a basic principle that we were all taught starting in grade school, which is where you started this program, and that is that under Article 1, Section 7, the Presentment Clause, the president has a job, either sign the law or veto the law. And here the president seems simply to have gone way beyond what most Americans understand as very, very basic constitutional democracy in this country. When you put these things together, there have been serious questions. I don't think, for example, that the president had the authority, as he claimed to do in a couple of cases, to disregard specific requirements to appoint officers to a new agency within a certain period of time. The White House said that interfered with the appointment power. Similarly, the president, I don't think, had the authority to say that he would not meet the minimum qualifications for particular officers of the executive branch, the appointees to be in new offices that Congress required in a particular statute. I don't think the president had the authority to refuse to provide information to Congress on the operation of programs so that it could conduct oversight. I don't think it had the constitutional authority to do any of these things, and I think it raises some very serious problems.
Mm-hmm. So again, I realize we're kind of going over some of the same ground, but I guess the bottom line here is, as far as you're concerned, is that you can say that a number of recent presidential administrations, at least going back to Ronald Reagan, have as much as they could, they have pushed the envelope when it comes to the power of the executive. Do you think that it is the case, though, that this administration has pushed it further than anybody else?
I don't think there's any question about that. And I would definitely say much further than the Reagan administration did in many important respects. These signing statements are, first of all, extraordinarily systematic. They haven't just picked out important conflicts that the White House had with Congress. They've been almost every single one of the statutes, whether they were important or unimportant, they've done this. And in each case, there's been this formulaic language, this broad sweeping language like what I just read you. And it has just continued that way over time. And there have been just objection on objection on objection. And it's not the case that that's what previous administrations did, whether we're talking about Republicans or Democrats. There were some controversies in previous administrations, certainly in Reagan, Bush 1, Clinton. There were indeed controversies in areas where the president openly took on something that the Congress had done. But this one has been consistent, and it's been sweeping. And not only that, it's made exclusive claims to power. That is, not only do we have the power under the unitary executive, but the fact that we have it means that the legislature and the courts don't. And that is different than what we've seen before. Just to give you an idea of how, again, how far they've pushed the envelope, Congress created a statistical unit in the U.S. Department of Education to produce research reports. Certainly not something that anybody was particularly concerned about or problematic. Yet the White House objected because Congress said, and by the way, Congress from time to time may ask for some reports from this department, too, about what's going on in the field of education. The White House said that's an interference with the executive function. That just gives you an idea of how far the administration's been willing to push it in areas that really don't have anything to do with national security or war or anything else.
Let's talk. Let's take another caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello. Is there the background on President Wilson's assisting Winston Churchill in setting up the imaginary country of Iraq in 1918 and the invasion of the Central American states to help with the setup of the United Fruit Company? Was that through executive order or was that through congressional action?
Oh, I don't know about that. But I will tell you this. One of the things that I did write about in the By Order of the President book, I did look specifically at the coup in Iraq that put the Shah back on the throne, and also the coup in Guatemala that moved the Arbenz regime out. These were, of course, both during the Eisenhower administration. And there's a chapter in there that talks about national security directives. Now, these devices were not created until the Truman years, and the reason is because they started life as memoranda that came out of the National Security Council, which, of course, was created in 1947. And what happened was these memoranda would be prepared by the staff, and then there'd be a discussion by the National Security Council about what to do about a particular issue. And if the council agreed and the president agreed, then the president would sign these, and they would be called national security directives. And then the agencies involved would carry them out. So at least since the Truman years, there's more information about how these devices were used. Most of these are classified, although we now have a lot of the national security directives from Truman, Eisenhower, all the presidents up to at least Clinton, and we even have quite a number from Clinton. There are even some currently that are unclassified that are available on the World Wide Web.
Is there the possibility that our republic, which is set up under a national democracy or a constitutional democracy, is too similar to the European republic that was active in 28? And can you make any comment about something like that?
I think that's a little bit beyond where I'm comfortable commenting at this point. That's a very broad statement. Let's put it this way. I do think that one of the things that we've been reasonably good about over history is to adapt how we work under the Constitution and what Louis Fisher calls a constitutional dialogue. We've tried to adapt what we're doing and yet remain faithful to the Constitution by trying to figure out where it is that the branches need to actually fight out important conflicts in separation of powers, and how they can work together in other cases to avoid unnecessary conflict and get done what needs to be done. And the Supreme Court has picked up on that and said, look, when we're understanding presidential power these days, we look to the relationship between what Congress has done and what the president has done. If Congress has agreed with the president, then we will say the president acts with the most authority. If Congress disagrees, he's at his weakest point. If it's not clear what Congress's position is, then the courts will look at the individual situation. I think it's what we've done there, and it's evolved over time, certainly over the decades, is this attempt to operate from a constitutional dialogue. This administration has chosen to reject that dialogue.
Yeah, but it does seem, again, and maybe that this administration has gone further than others, but that it does seem that administrations are always looking for something. Either they're going to look for something that exists and hasn't been used that much. They're going to look for something. They're going to invent something. So we're going to have signing statements and security directives and executive orders. They're going to look for some way, some edge that they can have to get what they want done, even if when sometimes the Congress doesn't want that thing to be done.
Well, there's no question that the pull and haul of the separation of powers was supposed to create, and the Supreme Court has reminded us this many times, a kind of hydraulic pressure to make us constantly pay attention to what the government is doing and what the branches are doing. And it is true that the Reagan administration liked national security directives and signing statements. The Clinton administration liked presidential memoranda. Carter liked executive orders. This administration seems to like the full array of these tools, and the question then becomes, is that hydraulic pressure working? Is Congress paying attention? Are people paying attention generally? And how far are people pushing these things? Is it part of a constitutional dialogue, or has it gone beyond that?
Well, that gets to, and we're unfortunately almost out of time, but that, I think, gets to a basic point that, that concerns a lot of people, and a concern that has been raised, I think, more over the last few years, and that is that Americans don't really understand this basic principle that I guess I would have thought we all were taught in grade school about the structure of government, the fact that there were supposed to be these three co-equal branches whose powers were supposed to balance and check the others so that no single branch was supposed to be preeminent. And there seems to be some question about whether, in fact, people understand that basic concept, that at least that was the idea at the beginning.
I don't think there's any question that there's been this interesting tension in the American public. On the one hand, the American public wants fast action. It wants things done. It wants problems solved. And oftentimes, when people feel that way, they look to the executive branch to do that. That's been true of Democrats. It's true of Republicans. And in those circumstances, sometimes Americans get a little annoyed with the idea of Congress asking questions and pressing the executive in these matters. As long as it goes on within certain boundaries, generally speaking, we've said, well, okay, we'll accept that sometimes executive is going to claim a little more power. Sometimes Congress will push back, as in the post-Watergate years of the 1970s, for instance. And when that happens, the White House might push back in the 1980s. And in this administration, there's no doubt that Mr. Cheney came to office with very strong memories of that period. He was very concerned at that time in the 1980s about what he saw as congressional incursion and is very much concerned now about it and has been one of the leading voices in that area. But it is true that unless the envelope is pushed a bit, the American public tends not to pay that much attention to it. It seems as though the envelope has been pushed.
Yeah. Well, there we must leave it. With our thanks to our guest, Philip Cooper. He's professor of public administration in the Hatfield School of Government at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon. If you're interested, by the way, in reading about presidential power, you might take a look at his book, By Order of the President, The Use and Abuse of Presidential Direct Action, published by University Press of Kansas back in 2002. Professor Cooper, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, and food and original works of art, located near the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444. That's it for us. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, the host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk